Welcome to the Truth Exchange podcast. This is the unique program where we have conversations about worldview, all through the lens of oneism and twoism. This lens is based on Romans 1:25. We have exchanged the truth of God for the lie, worship and serve creation rather than the Creator who is blessed forevermore. Amen.
Amen.
I am your host, Joshua Gila, with Mary Weller. Mary,
hi,
welcome
Joshua.
Back.
Thank you for having me again. It's good to be on with you. It's been a while
Indeed.
Since we recorded.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of things in the works. One of the things I'll go ahead and let a little bit out of the bag is that we have an event. It's a mini think tank that's going to take place June 5th through the 6th. Here in Columbia, South Carolina. It's hosted by King's ARP Church. It's also helped sponsored by a number of the other local churches in the area.
Wonderful.
It's called the Peter Jones Lectures, and we'll be sharing more information about that soon. But that's kind of where I have been, and Mary, you've been working with me on that.
Yes.
But it is good to be doing podcasting again as a resource. The substance of this particular episode that we're going to be doing, I've had a lot of people recently ask me, when are we going to do another update on the transgender books? We did a two-part episode back in 2001, and I've had a lot of people tell me that that's one of the...
2021.
What did I say?
2001.
2001, nope.
Right after 9/11.
We were not... In 2021, thank you. I've had people say that that's one of their favorite episodes. It's because it was so informative. It really clued people into what not only what's going on, but really the theology of one or two. You really honed in on what are people saying, what are the arguments that are being laid out, and what is the faithful Christian response to it. So I think one of the things that we should do is we should revisit some of those points of those two episodes,
sure.
And then we'll then come to where are we at today, and that's typically one of the modus operandi of Truth Exchange is where did we come from, where is it going, and where are we at now? We always had we likened it to kind of looking at a subway map, and in living in the land of blur, that's very very helpful, and so.
Yeah.
Let's set the stage. We've already mentioned Romans 1:25.
Mm-hmm.
I'll mention then again, like I did in those episodes on gender, Genesis 1:27, which is that in the beginning, God made them male and female mm-hmm. after his image, after his likeness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked you this question from that podcast, and I'm going to ask it again. Let's define some terms here.
Okay.
What is the definition of sex?
Okay.
And what is the definition of gender? And
okay.
Then last, what is the definition of transgender?
Okay. So just to give our listeners and viewers a little background information on this, Joshua and I joke a lot that you're the extra little brother I never knew I wanted. So I feel like sometimes we have conversations like I do even with my husband where he's like, yeah, no, remember we're going to do this. And I'm like, well, actually I do that to him too. No, I told you. It turns out I just thought it. So I have not rewatched those episodes, but immediately when you asked me, what is the definition of sex? There has been so much that's changed about that conversation since we recorded those episodes in 2021. And so
sure.
Typically what you would hear people say about what is male and what is female, people would respond, well, a female has XX chromosomes and a male has XY chromosomes, and there you are. But what came into the conversation, I mean, that's correct, right? But what
right.
has come into the conversation as a result of trans influence, the whole conversation about developmental disorders within sex has come up. So there are people who have chromosomal anomalies, right? So they have
right.
sexual development. So you do have people that just aren't explicitly XX or XY. And
mm-hmm.
And that's really important, I think, for Christians to understand, because that whole conversation about what they call DSDs. And so if I refer to DSDs, that's disorders of sexual development, really seemed to muddy the conversation and convince some people that in some instances, there were people who were truly trans because there was some anomaly in their XX or XY chromosomal.
And am I correct in understanding those individuals are typically the minority?
Yes.
When we're talking about the trans.
Yeah, a huge minority.
And I have watched a number of debates or even Q&A where there's been apologists and there's been a number of men who I've seen, they've been up on the stage and they're doing a Q&A and the trans question will come up. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, there's always somebody in that audience who just happens to be one of those people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're
whether they are or not, and that's kind of, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because even if they were a larger percent of the population than they actually are, I mean, it's a infinitesimally small percentage of the population. What is important for Christians to understand is that disorders of sexual development are disorders of male sexual development or disorders of female sexual development. They do not result in a third gender. And so the disorders actually prove the binary, that humans are either male or female, and there is no third gender. And so in defining now what male and female sex means, I have this to add, and some of our listeners may have heard of this and some of them probably have not, because I don't know anyone who gets in the weeds like I do on stuff like this generally. But a male is a human being whose system is ordered towards small gamete production. In other words, his system is ordered to make sperm.
Right.
A female is a human being whose system is ordered towards large gamete production. She produces eggs, and or she's organized so that she should be able to produce eggs, whether she can or not. Infertility has no bearing on whether one is truly male or female. And so
because the telos is there still.
Correct. Yeah. And so that organization may be disordered. It may not function properly, but it does not create a third type of gamete, a third type of reproductive cell. Therefore, it does not create a third gender. There are only two sexes. There are only two genders. A gender is the therefore of sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I am female. I am organized towards large gamete production. I don't happen to have a disorder, you know, of sexual development, but whether or not I'm in the process of bearing a child, I am a female. And therefore my gender, the things that I do, I do in feminine ways. So it's a type issue. So I hope that helps kind of update things for our audience. And I want to say too, that there are swaths of people who actually do legitimately have disorders of sexual development. And this conversation that trans activists and trans ideologues have had, where they've tried to lump people with DSDs into the trans movement, has actually done a lot of damage to people who legitimately do have disorders of sexual development and have been fighting to be accepted within the ranks of male or female based on what they actually are. This whole trans idea has actually made that conversation and that acceptance very, very difficult for them. And so I just want to put that out there. It was a muddying of the waters. And there are still, according to actual science, only two sexes, male and female.
Yeah, I love that update because, you know, in our original, we were talking about gender roles, and in the podcast you had talked about how, you know, what I do, I'm going to say is me, but what I do things in a masculine way. Mm-hmm. It almost did leave a bit I think because some of the conversation hadn't shifted yet,
right?
Where you had to, you kind of had to fortify, really telos and bring the telos of what male and female has that built-in telos for it.
Yeah.
And I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about Peter Jones' quotes. I think it's Henry Van Til. I was trying to look up the quote, but it's something to the effect that God could have created 1,000 other Adams to help Adam, but it would not have accomplished anything.
Right.
Because only one Eve could actually accomplish the mandate.
Right. And I think that that's another thing that's so important for Christians to remember when we talk about male and female, is that we were not just created male and female in God's image. We were created male and female in God's image for a sanctified purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Adam didn't need help just to kind of like make his breakfast in the morning, right?
So that's helpful.
It's helpful, but another male could have done that for him, right?
That's right.
This companion that God created for him as a complement, the reason she is a complement is because she's different. Because she brings something else to the table that will help him accomplish that mandate. And if she had been created first, God wouldn't have created more females to get it done, right? It had to be Adam and Eve because they were created for a purpose. And we can't separate those things out. And I think the fact that for so long we allowed those things to be separated, the actuality of who we are and the why of who we are, because we allowed that to be separated in the conversation, like just one mattered, is why we've had all of this grief.
Yep. Let's talk about the definition then of transgender. I told my oldest son that we were going to do this podcast. He had read C.S. Lewis's book. I think it's either the Silent Out of the Silent Planet or it's Paralandra, and it mentions it. C.S. Lewis uses the word transsexual.
Yeah.
Does he use transsexual? I forget if he used transsexual or transgender, but we were talking about God transcends sexuality.
Yeah.
And so he asks, okay, so wait, are you saying that God is androgynous? No, God is not androgynous. He is not male and female. He is spirit. He doesn't have a body like man. How do we define transgenderism or transgender?
So it's really interesting that you started with the word transsexual, because that was the original term to reference this group of people, right? And the idea was that if you could change their bodies enough, surgically change their presentation enough, that they would transcend sex and they could go from one to the other, right? So I think it might have been back in the 1930s. I would need to go back and look at this, but like the original sex change procedures, and for the listener only audience, like I'm doing heavy air quotes.
Sure.
There was a man, I think he might have been British, and he had been in World War II. I want to say this is all off the top of my head, but he did start having surgeries where they did try, and forgive me, I'm going to say right up front for those who have their kids listen, I am going to be using genitalia terms, but he had a quote unquote neo vagina created. And eventually they did try to give him a uterus. They tried to do a uterine transplant, and that eventually is what killed him. But they were trying to change his sex by changing his system to one that was organized towards being able to bear children, right?
And that was
successful for a whole myriad of reasons. And there's still, it's the same reasons that people who go through, you know, quote unquote, sex change procedures now devastate their bodies because you can't do it. So that's what a transsexual is. But then we had people like I believe it was Judith Butler who started talking about how a woman was not a woman because she was born a woman, but because she's taught to perform femininity, right? So then your existence as a female is performance. So it's the things that you do that seem feminine that make you a female. So it becomes a social construct. And that's where then we started having this idea that you could be transgender, not transsexual, because the way that you perform, the way that you behave, the way that you appear on the outside is simply a performance. And that's, that's where this idea of transgender started being presented. So you used to have transsexuals who went through surgeries. You had transvestites who are men who dressed and presented as women. Eddie Izzard is a good example of an early well-known transvestite who is a comedian who was wildly popular, I think, in like the late 90s and early 2000s. He's still around. But he presented as a transvestite. In other words, he was wearing femaleness, but there wasn't this idea that that meant that on the inside he truly was female. So then there was this Gnostic idea that came in that there is an inner self who is your true self, and that is your gender. And your gender might not match your sex. So you have a sexed body, but your true self is your inner self. Body, in a very Gnostic way, starts meaning less because, and becomes meaningless, essentially, because it's merely the container. You know, we've used that term, the meat envelope is one of the crude ways that you hear that talked about. So your container is sexed, but your true self is your spirit self. Only you can know it. And this is one of the things that gets presented in these children's books all the time, right? So only you can know who you are on the inside. And so that's why people might think that you're one thing, but you have to spiritually evolve to the point where you can tell them that you're another thing. And then all of the material about you needs to be changed to try and match that.
And this is where the Gnosticism is the putting off of the flesh, mm-hmm. and changing that to, which is evil,
it
bad.
Is evil. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. to make it good, you have to change it to reflect your inner self or your true self.
Right.
And this is also where it's oneism, yes. is that you are joining the opposites of the male and female, making them into one.
Right.
And so,
which begs the question, right? Like, why does the rapper, quote unquote, the rapper matter then? If it's meaningless and it's only about who you are on the inside, like, why does it matter then to change your body? But it's really interesting because people who make these claims, not all of them medically change. Mm-hmm. Some of them don't, or some of them can't for various reasons. But why would it matter? Well, it's really interesting because a lot of men who believe that they are quote unquote women on the inside, then they want to be able to perform femaleness. And that includes having periods, having babies, being able to breastfeed. So their rapper cannot perform their sense of what they are, right? And they have mm-hmm. this separation where they think that their rapper doesn't matter, but it needs to conform to who they think they are on the inside. So it becomes a God function. It's very-
Well, this just came to me. It's a oneist way of doing science. Mm-hmm. It's a oneist way of doing medicine.
Yes.
Because God is the God of medicine. He is the God of science. He's given, he ordered our world in such a way, yeah. as the creator. And for us to use science, for us to use medicine, for us to use surgery, mm-hmm. in this way is a distortion of what is supposed to be good and beautiful and true. And mm-hmm. so for doctors to do this is actually that it's so, you know, people ask, is there a Christian way to do science? Well, yes.
Yeah.
Right. It's according to the natural order that God has set up. Is there a Christian way to do medicine? Well, yes. Yeah. But giving people puberty blockers, which doesn't pause their puberty.
No.
Right. It distorts it. And is there a Christian way to do surgery? Well, yeah. it involves not cutting out healthy tissue.
Well, yeah, it involves not cutting out healthy tissue, and it involves acknowledging that we are embodied beings. Mm-hmm. We're not meat containers with a true self on the inside. We are whole human beings, and that involves both spirit and body. We make this weird separation between the two. And I think as Christians, we even fall into that as well. But why does it matter what we do with our bodies? Why does it matter that we honor our bodies? It's because we are whole creations in the image of God. And so science needs to acknowledge that as well. And
yep. It's
not just science. You know, it's interesting when you look then, Joshua, at this idea that people who believe that they're a different quote unquote gender on the inside, separate from what their body tells them about the reality of who they are. It's not just medicine that gets pressed into conforming itself to that inner God, right? That inner
identity. Yep.
But then people have to change their language. The laws have to change. Like, this really is an ideology that's not just about the right of the individual to live as their quote unquote true self, because living quote unquote as their true self demands that every institution conform itself around the sense of the individual, the divine, demanding, powerful sense of the individual. We must submit to that. And so people are told to submit their language, you know, like laws have to be changed so that men can go into women's changing rooms, so that they can compete in female sports, so that, you know, all of these different things. So it becomes an effort at power, and it must become an effort at power because it's denying objective reality, and it can't change it. So it becomes very violent. And that's a theme that I come back to all the time, is that we do violence at the end of this, not just to individuals who have this sense, but then to the people around them, you know? In the case of, for instance, like the murder of Charlie Kirk, you have a group of people who are involved in that, or at least that the shooter was involved in, that we refer to now kind of in gender critical circles as transtifa. And that is because they believe that their rights to exist as they perceive themselves on the inside are so important that it is worth killing over. If you will not conform, then your life must be ended, because you are not submitting yourself to like the inner divine sense of these people, that they are something that reality does not match up to.
In that two-part series, we covered a number of books. I'll just highlight quickly three that stood out. I Am Jazz, mm-hmm. It Feels Good to Be Yourself, mm-hmm. and Neither. Yes. And that was kind of the cute book.
I know, Neither makes me really sad.
Every week we go to the public library, and it's kind of the treat of the week for my kids, and for me. but I was curious, how much does literature have an impact today? One of the things we did highlight was there were some children's programs that were really pushing transgender ideology. I was thinking of Muppets, the Muppet mm-hmm. Babies.
Blues Clues.
I think Blues Clues. Mm-hmm. And there's been a few others that have come out that have pushed mm-hmm. for it. And there was something I saw. I don't know if it was SCOTUS Today or if it was an Al Mohler, but it was highlighting how the impact of social media has had on generation, the Gen Zers.
Yes.
And I wonder, you know, for us older fogies, we relied on literature as a medium of information, but now today it's kind of shifted more towards visual social media. Mm-hmm. From Blue Sky to YouTube to TikTok as a means of dissemination of information. And I wondered, is there a competition between literature or children's books today and versus social media?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And it's one I hadn't really thought about, but my instinct is no, there's not so much a competition as a collaboration between the two, right? So take the book, I Am Jazz, for instance, and we're not going to go over that book today because we went over it in detail in those other, I think it was the first of the three books that we did in those other two episodes because it's such an influential book. But Jazz Jennings, I mean, he is a social media influencer and he's on TV and he wrote this children's book and you can go on YouTube and hear him read the book to kids in his own voice. And so, and you, you know, so they, it's a collaboration between. And I think especially for small, small kids, it's interesting because, I mean, you do see kids like in their strollers or you see kids at restaurants with their parents sitting at the table with an iPad or with a phone, and they're just taking in this content, you know, so certainly they're affected by that. But books are still a huge part of what is presented to children as like the good learning tools that they should go to. And using I Am Jazz again, so for instance, Los Angeles Unified School District, which is in all kinds of hot water for all kinds of reasons right now, but it's the second largest school district in the nation. They have a calendar called Queer All School Year. I talked about this in my lecture for one of our online symposia. I think it was maybe in 2022, Stealing from Babies was the name of that talk. And I go over the LAUSD Queer All School Year calendar. And a huge part of that for Coming Out Week is every day they read a different children's book. And we're talking about all the way down to pre-K.
Wow. Okay, yeah. And that lecture was from the State of our Disunion online symposium. Yep. Yeah,
right.
I will link that in our show notes so people can go and listen to that one. Yeah, it's a great one. Okay.
So adults
with a really long title.
It was such an evocative title, I feel. no, but I do go over that because adults reading books to kids who can't read yet puts truths and ideals into an adult's words. So they're reading the words of an author, but they're reading it authoritatively to children. And some of these are fanciful. Many of them are allegorical, but some just come straight out and say it in these children's books. One of the other ones, and I think we did go over that in one of the first two episodes also, was It Feels Good to Be Yourself. And in that book, I mean, it just straight out is being presented as a truth to kids that a boy can be trapped in a girl's body. A girl can be trapped in a boy's body. A child can be neither a boy nor a girl or both a boy and a girl at the same time. You know, so, and these ideas come through in ways that are really interesting. I recently interviewed a couple for another project that I'm working on whose daughter identified for a long time as transgendered, but she went from identifying first as a lesbian, then to being a demigirl, which is just one of these, I can't even remember how to describe what demigirl is. But then she went from demigirl to non-binary, and then so neither a boy nor a girl, and then she went from non-binary to transgender. And in each phase, she was convinced that that was who she was, that had to be accepted, acknowledged, and embraced, right? So these ideas are presented in these children's books as reality, and we have evidence, lots and lots of evidence then, that they're not just presented as reality, but they're taken on as reality by a growing number of the children who hear them, right? So children's books are really important because they are the tools that adults pick up and read these condensed ideas to kids who are forming their worldview around what the adults in their lives tell them is true. So you have parents who take their kids to these reading story hours. You have teachers who read these books in their classrooms. And I think that's something that's really important for our listeners to understand, is that these books that I'm talking about, these are not fringe books. You know, I live in Escondido, California. It's a largely pretty staunchly conservative, heavily churched town in Escondido, or in Southern California. We have Westminster Seminary. We have a ton of churches in our area. And yet I did a search of each of the titles that I talk about in the school, the elementary district school libraries, and every single library had at least one of these books. Some of the school libraries at the elementary level had multiple copies, many of which were checked out at the time, meaning that they were being used. So these aren't fringe books that you have to go looking for. They get presented to your kids in school, online, at the library, at Barnes and Noble, yeah. You know, any of those places that you're going to take your kids. And they're very yeah. attractive.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I take my kids to the library every week, and uh-huh. our library is always as on display, everything LGBTQ+ to all kinds of pagan ideologies that's influenced them. Mm-hmm. And this is in, you know, in South Carolina in the Bible Belt.
Right.
So it's, right. it's here. I mean, it's,
yeah.
So let's yeah. talk about the books then.
All right.
Here we go.
Well, here we go. So the first book that we're going to talk about is My Shadow is Pink. And Joshua, I'll send you some shots of the interior of My Shadow is Pink. And this book came on my radar, I want to say in 2023. So it was after we had done the initial episodes where I was looking at children's books. And the reason that this book, My Shadow is Pink, came to my attention is because Encinitas, which is a town we've mentioned many times on this podcast, one of our coastal towns here in San Diego, which also was teaching my son yoga when he was in kindergarten. Encinitas had teachers at an elementary school level who decided to have their kids read My Shadow is Pink. And so I did some research, and it's, again, one of these very popular books. You can find it anywhere. I went to Barnes & Noble and pulled it right off the bookshelf. Wow. And also bought its companion, My Shadow is Purple, which we're not going to go over as much today because the content's sort of the same. But so in Encinitas, the teachers had fifth graders who either watched a video of a reading of My Shadow is Pink or they read it themselves. And then there's a buddy system in Encinitas where fifth graders, older kids, are introduced to kindergartners, and they're their buddies for the entire year. They do activities with them, they support them, they kind of just build them up and take care of them. In a lot of ways, it's a very sweet system. My kids all had buddies when they were in school too, whether they were in public school or at Christian school. And so the teachers took the fifth graders to the kindergarten buddy class, and they also read My Shadow is Pink in the buddy class. And then they had the fifth graders pair up with their buddy and do a My Shadow is Pink coloring exercise, where they were supposed to help their buddy decide what color their shadow was, right? And the implication of the book is that a boy has a blue outside, but his shadow might be a different color on the inside. Okay. And that shadow is his true self. And so hang on one second. I just want to explain it the way
very Jungian language there too. Shadow as the true self.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought of that, Joshua. You're totally right. So at some point, this little boy is talking about how his shadow is pink. And so he says, my dad has a shadow that's blue as can be, and there's nothing but blue in my whole family tree, but mine is quite different. It's not what you think, for mine is not blue. My shadow is pink. And so what you see, and I'll send an image of this, is this little boy, he's dressed in jeans and he's sitting and he's angry. And then this big pink shadow is like emanating out of him, right? My shadow loves ponies and books and pink toys, princesses, fairies, and things, quote, not for boys. But there's one thing it likes most, I have found. It loves wearing dresses and dancing around. And so it shows the little boy dancing around in his blue jeans, but his shadow now has a tutu on and is twirling around until dad finds him. And dad tells him, don't worry, you know, it's just a phase. You're going to get over this. And he's really concerned. And it says, dad's shadow is blue. It's big and it's strong. But when I stand with it, I just feel so wrong. I wish mine was blue like all of the others. I wish mine was blue like my dad's and my brother's. I'd be part of the group. Of that, there's no doubt, but I cannot fit in when my shadow stands out. So in other words, he can't control any of these impulses on the inside, and he shouldn't control any of these impulses on the inside of his shadow, because that shadow is his true self. He's only just fighting against the exterior. So in this book, and it talks about how he's getting ready for his first day of school. So think of the implications of that. He's never been to school before. This kid's a preschooler, right? He's getting ready to start his first day of kindergarten. And one of the first things that they're told that they need to do is to wear, to dress up. It's going to be a dress up day.
All right, you can see where this is going.
You're going to dress up your shadow in its favorite thing. So now we're acknowledging that everyone has a shadow, right? And so his shadow needs to dress in its favorite thing. And so he puts on a dress. And his dad is really concerned, but dad takes him to school in his dress. He goes in and the kids are all shocked. And so then he feels bad and he runs away and he goes back home and swears that he'll never wear the dress again. But then dad, who has been presented as this burly, like lumberman, he wears like blue jeans and a red flannel and he's got hair all over his arms. Dad comes in and now he's dressed also in a pink dress. Okay.
Wow.
And starts to explain to the little boy that even though when he looks at the pictures of all their family, their generations of family going back through the years, he's misunderstood that all of them had shadows too, and some of their shadows didn't match their outside. So he has this whole, you know, kind of like LGBTQ history legacy that he's never known about. You know, there was a shadow who was a girl, but her shadow likes girls. So this implication of lesbianism. There's a shadow where, there's an old, like kind of British man looking man in a three-piece suit, you know, but that he loved art and fashion. And so, you know, his shadow is different. So his dad goes through that. And then his dad tells him, and this is really important. So I've talked often about how the fundamentals of transgender ideology get boiled down into very simple explanations when you read them in children's books. And that's why I think that they're so important. So dad sits down in his pink, I'm just going to show this to you, Joshua. It's so crazy. See the dad's pink plaid with the tutu. So dad sits down and this is what he tells the little boy. Your shadow is you. And pink it will be. So stand up with your shadow and yell, this is me. And that is like the big bold type along the page. So your body has nothing to do with it. Your sense of your interior self is your true self. This is me. And some they will love you and some they will not. But those that do love you, they'll love you a lot. So put on that dress and get back to school. If someone won't like you, then they are the fool, right? So if you, and the whole idea of won't like you. So if another child looks and says, no, you actually are a boy, and this makes me uncomfortable, not only are they mean, that's the implication of just a bully, but they're also foolish because they're denying what is true, right? Yep. So dad walks him back to school and they both wear their tutus, even though people were staring at them. And I stride into class, I puff out my chest. I may be different, but different is best. So that's a moral, like another moral implication of this, right? I join a small group, And though I don't blend, they look up and smile, will you be our friend? So now all of a sudden, all of the kids accept him because he's living as his true self. And that's the end of the book.
Wow.
So, I mean, this book did result in a lawsuit. And what's interesting is that there are people who have tried to claim, well, no, these books aren't actually trying to make kids think that they might be transgender. But what came out during the lawsuit over this book in Encinitas, the reading of this book, and parents who wanted to be able to opt their kids out of these activities, was that the teachers who were doing this activity were text messaging each other, really excited about how they might suddenly cause some of their kids to realize that they were trans, that their inner shadows needed to come out, right? So it was an exercise in trying to confuse children about reality and then to draw that confusion out so that it could be celebrated. When the little boy and his family contacted the school, the fifth grader and his family contacted the school and complained about the activity, the local PTA in that district organized a Pink Out the Hate Day. So this little boy was painted as being hateful because he was uncomfortable with the exercise. And all of the school administrators, all of the teachers, and the majority of the students all wore pink to pink out the hate, to basically object to his sense that what they were doing was wrong. And his kindergarten buddy said to him too that he was really uncomfortable with the coloring activity. But so that is one example. And if you have any questions about the story, we can talk about it. But that is one example of one of these children's books with, I mean, let's be real, like the teachers didn't draw the ancillary activities up. There are ancillary activities to take into schools with these books to engage children with the ideas that are in those schools. And if you're coloring what color your shadow is, you're being asked to internalize that truth and make it your own and live that out, right? So even if you're a child who's a boy and you color your shadow as blue, you're acknowledging that there was a possibility that your shadow could have been a different color. You're being asked to empathize with kids whose colors don't match their outside. And you're being taught that that's a reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was said in the last number of podcasts. I mean, it's a demonic ideology that's trying to create unnatural, anti-creational, anti-God categories in the, and it's a catechesis, right? And we've said this before over and over. If you don't catechize your children, the devil will.
Right.
And so he is busy, whether it be through, and we mentioned social media or online means, it's certainly happening in the public schools. It's happening in the libraries. We have to be vigilant. Parents need to be aware of these things. And so and that's what we are providing here in this podcast is a look into what's going on and to be level-headed in response and respond in a Christian and biblical way about these issues. So let's tackle the next one. What's the next book on the list?
The next one is called Red, A Crayon's Story. And I could not find my copy. There are a number of people who are writing books and doing video series for kids about these issues from a Christian perspective. And so I've loaned some of my books out and I couldn't find that one. So I'm gonna have to go find out who I gave it to. But A Crayon's Story is, or Red, A Crayon's Story. This is one of the books that I found in almost all of Escondido's elementary school libraries. When I spoke last year in Illinois, I'm trying to think, I was in Monroe County in Southern Illinois, right outside of St. Louis. I did a radial search like for school libraries in Southern Illinois too. And it's a very conservative area of the state. And this book, Red, A Crayon Story, was everywhere. There are a couple of schools here in Escondido where, there were very few of these books, but Red was in, I think, every single one of them. It's just, it's everywhere. Okay. So Red is the story about a crayon who is blue, but was born with a red wrapper. Okay. And so the red wrapper says Red on it. So Red's name is Red, and Red has a red wrapper. And so everyone expects Red to do Red things. And so one of the first things that happens is a teacher who doesn't think Red is being red enough tells Red that they should practice drawing strawberries together. And so the teacher draws a bunch of red strawberries, and then Red tries to draw those red strawberries, but they come out blue. And it's very disappointing, you know, and Red tries to color a fire truck, but it's a blue fire truck. And then all of the crayons in town and Red's family are talking about why Red is so bad at being red. And everyone has theories about how to help Red be more red, because clearly Red is red. And some of the quotes from the other crayons are, it doesn't seem like he's red at all. And one of the other crayons says, don't be silly. It says red on his label. Okay. So okay. Again, here's this idea that the label could be wrong, and the label's written on the wrapper, and the wrapper could be wrong. And there's this interior thing that is the truth about this crayon. And, but nobody recognizes it because the wrapper is the wrong wrapper. Okay.
Right.
So, one of the other crayons says he came that way from the factory, right? So he came from the factory. His interior is blue and his exterior is red, but they can't see his interior. They just see what's coming out of him, and they don't recognize that he's being his true self.
Wow.
So then other office supplies come in and they start trying to help Red be more comfortable. And so one of the characters is a pair of scissors, and it says, well, maybe your label is just too tight, and takes a couple of snips at his label. the tape comes in and says, oh, I just think you're broken on the inside. And so the tape tries to wrap some tape around the outside of the crayon so that the crayon can color red. And so all these office supplies try to change the exterior to make the interior match. I don't know. It's a little confusing, but they're all trying to just change things about the label to make Red be red. And Red is demoralized. Red is sad. Red feels like Red is wrong because Red can't do anything right. And then finally someone comes and says, would you help me color in the ocean for my, you know, my art project that I'm doing? And Red says, I'm not very good at coloring. And this character says, yes, you are. I know you can do it. And so Red goes to color the ocean and colors a beautiful ocean because Red is blue on the inside. It's just the label that was wrong, right? So then all of the crayons who were talking about how wrong Red was and how bad Red was, suddenly they realize, no, Red is actually blue, and blue is brilliant. And actually he's reaching for the skies, which is blue. And so he colors the sky. Right. And so everyone just needed to acknowledge that Red just had the wrong wrapper on. Such an easy thing to change. And then everything that Red did as blue is brilliant. And everyone's praising this crayon for recognizing that his interior really is blue. And the implication, it's actually very, very creepy, this book. The implication is that, so I'm just going to say, so it's like probably a girl. Red is probably like a girl in the story, and I'm using air quotes here, but that once they all realize he is blue, and the book does use those pronouns, he is blue, and allows him to do blue things, then he's living a great life and everybody loves him. But what's interesting is in the last page of the book, when he is coloring the sky, he still has the red wrapper on, and he has the cuts on the bottom of the wrapper that the scissors made. And he has tape wrapped around the top of him, where if you were to turn this character into a child, it would be where a young woman who had had double mastectomy done would have had bandages. And I've seen so many images of detransitioners or kids who have not desisted or detransitioned, but who just had quote unquote top surgery. And in these pictures, they have that gauze wrapped around their chests. And on the last page of this book, this crayon with a red wrapper, who is actually blue and great as blue, has that tape wrapped around the chest area. Right. So none of that harmed her. It let her become him, and he is his true self. Okay. So that is the idea of Red, a Crayon's story. And there are people again who are like, oh no, you know, this is not a trans book. This is just a book where, you know, children are being followed, told to follow their hearts or be their true selves.
Sure, but I mean, Jan.
Yeah, exactly. But there are interviews with the author who talks about, you know, trans identity. So Red, a Crayon's story is part of the reading list during National Coming Out Week on the Queer All School Year calendar for LAUSD. They do read this book all over the place. I mean, it's in children's libraries all across the country. It gets donated. Again, there are ancillaries. You can see it read by influencers on YouTube and on social media. So it's a widely read, highly popular book.
Yeah. And this is this furthers the whole ideology of trust your heart, trust yourself, trust your inner part. I mean, and our friend, Dr. Thaddeus Williams has a wonderful book, Don't Trust Your Heart.
Don't trust your heart.
The heart is wicked. It's deceitful. And encouraging children, really, I mean, to go against normative creation, this is incredibly dangerous, incredibly wicked. You know, and just furthering that it's almost, it's an encouragement to parents in these books to go against what is natural to them.
Right.
And rather than parents being the ones who are to protect, safeguard, lead, direct, teach, it says that no, that you don't know anything, mom and dad, your children do.
Yeah.
And they're more in tune and need to be let out. They need to let out that shadow and follow the whims of their heart, because in doing so, then they can truly become themselves, which is just radically evil.
Yeah.
It's radically evil.
Yeah. It's an entire ideology built exclusively on the oneist idea of self, a oneist idea of reality. There is no creator. There is no one outside of you who has determined lovingly and creatively and beautifully who you are, right? If he did, he's a God who could make mistakes, like putting a boy accidentally in a girl's body. So if a God is even acknowledged, he's acknowledged as a bumbling fool, right? And that, again, is Gnostic. It's creation is evil. The material world is evil. It was a foolish thing for that God to have done. He's not even really a God, so he's not worth worshiping. You look to self. And I've talked to parents, multiple parents, who, for whatever reason, they were told by people that they thought were Christian counselors. They've been told by school counselors. They've read Preston Sprinkle's book lays the weight of preventing suicide on, you know, using opposite name and pronouns. And I've talked to parents who, for various reasons, did the wrong thing, right? They went against their consciences. They went against their sense of right and wrong because they were going with the world's definition of love and did go along with new names and pronouns or trying to support their children in this. And I have had multiple mothers talk to me about doing it with a pit of dread and fear and guilt in their stomachs. It is a horrendous weight and strain. And then for these parents who did affirm some of these things, they've got mutilated children. They've got harmed children on the other side of this. And in some ways, whether they were manipulated to do it or not, they contributed to that, which also goes against the creational mandate, right? Like we're to have children, to fill the earth, to subdue it, and to raise our children up in the way that they should go. And in all of this, we are going against that mandate. And so the stress and the strain and the deterioration of family, the sense of guilt and weight that people carry around as a result of following this, even for quote unquote good intentions, is heartbreaking. Yeah. It is absolutely heartbreaking.
That's a good point that you just made, Mary, is that moving forward with this kind of trans ideology is for mom and dad to go along with it. It goes against the creation mandate. It goes against the cultural mandate that you would steward and teach your children to walk in that way. Now, granted, marriage isn't for everyone. The Apostle Paul talks about that, but that kind of calling is a very limited in its scope. And it's the what's normative, though, is the telos of our sexual design. Right. And that is that the to work in families. I always think about Pastor Ted Hamilton, who was my pastor and is your pastor at New Life Presbyterian Church. And I always loved whenever there would be a baptism for infants, or baptism in general, but specifically with infants being Presbyterian, is that he would say, God works in families.
Yes.
And he works through that. And so so to do this, to buy this is a rejection of families. It's a rejection of that created order and a rejection of that cultural mandate. Thinking through all these books, you and I did a podcast series last year on the 5 points of paganism and the 5 points of the gospel.
Yes.
And this whole, the transgenderism is that all is one. The male, and ultimately that we have to get past that there is no distinction between male and female, which is a shocker for Christians because we know that that to be true. And the culture is moving past that really at a very fast rate, I think, running past that there's those distinctions. They've embraced that there is a blur, that humanity is one. All religions are one. But of course, there's the problem. And the problem is that we make distinctions. There is male and female. Those things are normative. But when one of them rules the day, it has to go to war against twoism. It has to go against, make war with Christendom. Mm-hmm. And so this book says, well, there's a problem, mom and dad. We have to listen to our children. We have to do what's counter. And we need to listen to our children and listen to our children's shadow, because that is the true self. And that is the solution, is to reject those distinctions, reject those categories.
Right.
And I loved what, Peter, this is one thing that Peter has always taught, is that oneism and twoism, it gives you categories to work with. It gives you biblical categories. It gives you, it highlights the creational categories. And what these children's books are doing is going to war against those creational categories.
Right.
Male, female, father, mother, children. It reverses them. It reverses that order. It blurs that order. It blurs those distinctions. And so I really appreciate you coming on and doing that research and thinking through some of these books and really laying a groundwork for mom and dad to be aware when you're watching TV, when they're watching those videos, when they're on social media, when they're in the library, pay attention to the books that your children get. It's not a coincidence that there is a radical subversion here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a coincidence. And to touch back on what you're talking about with the usefulness of oneism and twoism as categories, and then seeing the other categories that result from that ultimate category of the creator creation distinction. I just want to touch on the article that you sent out yesterday, I think, to our mailing list.
Your article.
Yes. Let me talk about myself some more. No, I don't mean it that way. I don't mean it that way. But it's interesting because
I'm glad that you did. I'm glad that you did, though, because I was going to mention that everyone should go and read that article. What a great article it was.
Thank you. So Peter and I are in discussions about who plagiarized whom, because I spoke to him about James Tallarico, and I'm pretty sure I plagiarized him because he did the same thing in the lecture that we have coming out soon. However, in James Tallarico and the Great Commandment, you know, one of the scary things about this ideology as it's presented, and I think it's presented within transgender ideology almost more than anything else in our culture, like broad scale right now.
What's that?
Is the twisting of scripture to make Christians feel that they must affirm people in these delusions rather
because
than...
Because it's loving,
right? Yeah. And so with oneism and twoism, you know, I really sat down. So James Tallarico and Governor Andy Beshear.
Oh, yeah. Who is James?
Oh, James Tallarico is a seminary graduate who is running for a seat in the state of Texas. And he has been making huge waves in Texas, you know, conservative Bible Belt Texas. And yet when you listen to the things that he says, I mean, he just makes these theologically twisted statements that are just, are shocking. I mean, it really is shocking. And he is a oneist.
Yeah.
Okay. So he came out of seminary, having learned not to honor scripture, but to twist scripture. Mm-hmm. And so, he and, Kentucky's Governor Andy Beshear, and then a woman who spoke at a school board meeting recently, here in Escondido, after one of the school board members in our community, a male, came out as a trans woman, all referenced the quote unquote Great Commandment, right? And so I was thinking, like, gosh, how do I, because they're using scripture, how do I even respond to this use of scripture? And I've been trained over the years by Peter to sit and think, what are the oneism and twoism implications of this scripture that they're using, that to love your neighbor is the greatest calling, and therefore you must love your neighbor as they present themselves or as they claim to be, that that's the way to love them. And I realized, wait a second, no. First, Jesus said to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then the next commandment is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. That is a twoist explanation of love, that first you love God, and then God, who is creator, defines who your neighbor is and therefore how you love your neighbor, right? So that's a twoist understanding. And that helps us tackle then even these claims. And I mean, you saw it in both these books, right? That to love someone is to submit yourself to their ideas about who they are on the inside. That's giving the creation divine authority. God, the creator, has divine authority to say who we are and then how we love one another. And so in every capacity in this conversation, I really have found oneism and twoism to be incredibly helpful in analysis and response, even when scripture is being misused. It even helps you take in the full account of scripture when you hear these misrepresentations. So sorry for the long aside, but I actually do think that that's really important.
No, that is important.
Well, Joshua, thank you for allowing me to talk about these books. And I fully anticipate that I get a couple months break now from having to look at trans children's books again, because they make me really upset. I walk around grinding my teeth for days on end when I have to read these books. Now, I hope that this has been an addition to the usefulness that people have found in the first two episodes that we did in 2021 on children's books that talk about transgenderism. And I would just ask everyone who's listening or watching, please, would you take the time to like this episode, to share this episode, and to make substantive comments about the episode. We struggle a lot with the algorithm. And part of that is because we talk about things that the algorithm does not like. And so any interaction, any sharing that you do actually helps us get this information out to other people. If you haven't subscribed to the mailing list, you can go to truthexchange.com and sign up for that. And we're a ministry that exists because of the financial support of listeners and viewers like you. We're so thankful for every single one of you who have taken the time to regularly contribute or to send one-time gifts when your budget allows for that. We cherish those gifts because those are the things that allow us to keep doing this work, which we find both in our personal lives and then in speaking to other people who have gotten a hold of Truth Exchange's content. It's making real change for God's glory and people's good, the culture's good around us. And we're so thankful for that. And so if you have not done it, would you please prayerfully consider financially supporting Truth Exchange? And I think that wraps us up until next time. Joshua, thank you so much for hosting this episode.
Thank you, Mary, for being on the program as usual.